All aboard! The Clio Exchange Express is leaving the station. Welcome to the Clio Exchange Express, a conversation about the past, present, and future. A lively discussion between friends, family, pundits, personalities, and potentates, if necessary, in order to teach and learn something new. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the hour. Let's go to the show already in progress.
Well, hi there. Welcome on board the Clio Exchange Express. I'm Lou Phillips, one of your host conductors, and we're heading out on another life journey. It's a journey that will educate, inform, and inspire. We're going to take another look, and a very special look indeed, at our vault. And as we look inside the vault, we're going to be searching for a really legendary radio man. Well, I guess he's not just a radio man. He's an all-around music man because he spent so much time in all different forms and different genres of music, with a particular emphasis on African-American music. We're going to go to the archives and reach out again to our archivist, music guru, and all-around musicologist, Mr. George Chandler. But prior to that, you need to know that alongside of me is, once again, Mr. John Cheapton from over in London. Hey, John, how things?
Good evening from not so warm London, but I'm happy to be here this evening, and I'm looking forward to this episode tonight. Really looking forward to this.
We're not gonna spend a lot of time in advance of it either, because he's got a long runway that we can spend a great deal of time on before we actually take off. Because
that's for sure.
It's quite a story. But before we begin our conversation with our music guru, we want to let our listening audience know that it would really thrill us greatly for you to call in and be a part of the conversation. We're all being educated, but it's more important to get you involved in a way that will bring out a point that perhaps we will have missed. And you can do that at 15 after the hour by calling area code 646-716-7070. Again, at 15 after the hour, no matter where you are, we'd like for you to call. Give us a call at area code 646-716-7070. Okay, well, let's head on over to the vault and give a rap on the door for Mr. George Chandler.
All right. Welcome, welcome, everybody. This is George Chandler, and you're listening to George Talking Music.
These arms are mine. They are lonely. Lonely and beautiful.
That's a sex machine to all the chicks. You're damn right. Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it?
All right, on tonight's show, we've got a music business giant. A man who has made his name as a radio personality, as a record producer, as a songwriter, and as a member of Sax Records, one of the heads of Sax Records. We're talking of none other than Mr. Al Bell.
That's right, George. And I tell you, he not only came into Sax Records as a member of the company, but by the end of his career, his tenure with Sax, he was the number one guy there. So he's got quite a story to tell, because yes, he accomplished so very much in the 19 years or so that Stax was around. And so we want to get it all out of him. Mr. Bell, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. I'm honored and humbled to be here.
Well,
I'd like to say welcome to you as well, Mr. Bell. Can we call you Al tonight?
Please do.
Wonderful.
You're trying to make an old man out of me calling me. I'm a millennial.
I was just going to say, there's one thing for sure. There are no Generation X's in this crowd. Go ahead, George.
I was going to say, let's start at the beginning. Where were you born, Al? I mean, tell us a little bit about the early days.
I was born in Brinkley, Arkansas. And Brinkley, Arkansas is half the distance between Little Rock, Arkansas, and Memphis, Tennessee. It's 60 miles from Little Rock, Arkansas, east of Little Rock, Arkansas. I was born there, and my family moved when I was 5 years of age from Brinkley to North Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was raised and grew up in North Little Rock, Arkansas. So I'm an Arkansas.
So you are definitely a Southern boy, aren't you?
Say again. I said you are definitely a Southern boy. Oh yeah, no, we're Southwestern. See, we're west of the Mississippi River, so we're Southwestern. yes, I'm a Southern boy, and you know, in Brinkley, in my hometown, I'm proud to say that we had two greats in that area. One, a distant cousin, Louis Jordan. You heard of him, Louis's brother.
Oh, yeah.
Louis Jordan. And then in Cottonpan, Arkansas, which was the city next door, Sister Rosetta Tharp.
Oh, wow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yes, yeah, so I came from a great area.
Yeah. Well, I'm from Atlanta. Yes. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and I grew up in Atlanta in the 50s.
Ah.
And so listening to all that good old Southern music, gospel music as well.
Oh, my God,
Al,
yes.
Al,
yes.
Let me just kind of set the stage here, because part of my promise to you was, even though we can't avoid talking about the great thing that you've done in the music business, but I think it's going to be very important for us to bring out the core that you grew from and that you ultimately displayed in all of your business arrangements, in talking to folks that have worked on both sides of the desk with you, those that were around you as staff folks, and then those who were business people doing business with you. Let's start at your household. Tell me a little bit about the house you grew up in.
The house I grew up in was in North Little Rock, Arkansas, and I had five brothers, a wonderful mother, and a father who had an eighth grade education and was a farmer and a landscaping contractor. And the older I get, the more I realize how wise he was, and the wisdom that he shared with me makes me wiser today as I go from day to day. My family comes from a long line of Seventh-day Adventists, so I had that in me and was really studying that, I guess, from the time that I came from my mother's womb.
Mm. How about?
That's it. That was during a period of segregation, and I'm 77 years of age, so you can imagine I was born in 1940. So mm-hmm. I had a chance to see some of all of it.
yes, you did, and not only that, but you lived in a community, a town, and a state that were not hiders of their feelings either.
Right. Exactly.
And I would think that in an environment like that, having the kind of spiritual foundation that obviously your mom gave you was pretty important, wasn't it?
It was. Then, as a matter of fact, without that spiritual foundation and that spirit living in me, I would not be on this phone talking to you today and still in this body on planet Earth.
I can imagine that. Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah. No.
Well, go right ahead.
No. I'm thankful to testify to that because it just shows the power of the creator of this universe and all of the laws associated with that power. And when we try to live by them, it's amazing what can and will be done in your life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's a wonderful testimony. Wonderful testimony.
Let me ask you this. Can you hear me, fellas?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I want to know, how is it that you got into radio in the first place?
It was purely an accident.
Uh-huh.
Purely an accident. As a matter of fact, in my senior year of high school, in a public high school, segregated, beautifully segregated public high school, I say beautiful because we were really taught back then. When I graduated from high school, I had what was comparable to a junior college education. But in my senior year, I was elected president of the student council and state president of the National Honor Society. And my campaign managers and the people that made up the campaign and directed it were all females. They were all girls. And they were smart, sharp girls. They got me elected as president of the student council. And after I was elected president of the student council, they came to me one day and said, listen, we want you to go to the principal and get the principal to start letting us have record hops, which was discos, after the football games and the basketball games. And I said, well, I don't know about that. I don't know what I should do that. They said, listen, we got you elected.
And I said, you were up.
You do
that was your first. That was your first lesson about leverage.
Leverage in politics. I knew from that point forward I didn't want to be a politician. But at any rate, I also was president of the Audiovisual Aid Society and Club, and that's where we kept all of the motion picture projectors and the stereo at that time. And I went to the principal, talked to him about it, and he said, no problem. He said, but you have to take it and put it in the multipurpose room, the stereo, and you have to handle it yourself and don't let anybody else touch it because I don't want anybody else to be involved with that. So I said, okay. I came back a couple of days later and asked him, where could I get some music? He said, well, we don't have any records. I said, what? But how am I going to do a record hop without records? He said, that's your problem. You figure it out. I thought about it, and I went back to the girls. I said, do you all have records? Yes, I said, well, I need your records, and because we don't have any records, we have the record. I said, well, let's get records from everybody at school. And I did. I got the records and went in and started playing them. But as I at the record hops, as I watched them dance, I can't dance. My sense of timing is horrible. I can't sing none of it. But I would watch. I would sit there and watch them dance and see how they interacted with each other. And I'd start asking them about the music, the girls in particular. What did they feel about the Platters and Johnny Mathis and you name it? And they tell me how they felt about the song. So after they told me, I set a mic up, and as I would play the music, I'd say something about the songs, but it was what the girls had told me about the songs. I learned how to take the music and interact with them through the music and cause them to do certain things that they normally wouldn't do, just make them feel good and really enjoy themselves. And I knew how to play a certain record and get those guys that were the wallflowers, make the girls go get them off the wall and start dancing. At any rate, I put together a back then an American Idol type show between our two high schools, North Little Rock and Little Rock High School, and they had just opened a black radio station here, the first one in town, and I got the station manager, the key disc jockey, and the head of our music department to come in and act as judges in this contest that I had between the students from the two schools, and I sat up and emceed it. At the end of that, the station manager came to me and said, listen, I want you to come by next Friday after you get out of school and meet with me. Well, Friday at 3:30, school's open, closed, got the bus, went by the radio station, and I said, Mr. Phelan, who was his name, wanted me to come by and talk with him. The lady said, this is his office right here, walked me to it. I walked in his office. He said, sit down, young man. I sat down. He looked at me and he said, you have an uncanny gift to gab. I didn't know what he was insulting me or what he was saying. But then he said, I'm going to make a disc jockey out of you. And he hit me on the radio that Sunday morning. That was a Friday, Sunday morning at 6 o'clock. I was on the radio with another disc jockey teaching me how to handle the board and the equipment and all of that. And I started doing the jazz on Sunday. And finally, I ended up doing morning drive and afternoon drive. In college, I worked my schedule around, so and the school accommodated me
until he called you in and said he's going to make you into a disc jockey, you had never thought about being a disc jockey before?
I didn't have no thoughts about that at all.
Wow.
And shocked when he said that to me. No thoughts at all. Because all I'd been doing was just playing that little music that senior year for the students and enjoying them, enjoying themselves, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, there was something pretty unique about this station manager, wasn't it?
Oh, my God, yes. He taught me some things back then that I live with now. I thank him for it. He was a white gentleman that was very, very intelligent. And when I say intelligent, my definition of intelligence is the ability to comprehend or understand. And he said to me, now what I want you to do, this is when he put me in morning drive and afternoon drive. He said, Al, at 5 minutes before the hour at 55, we do news. So what I want you to do, I want you to go around to the barbershops, beauty salons, restaurants, and those places, and I want you to listen to what the people are talking about, black people are talking about, Negroes at that time. See what Negroes are talking about, and I want you to listen to the music that they're playing. Go by the record shop, go into the restaurants where they have the jukeboxes. He said if they're playing music on the jukebox, you know that's what they love because they have to pay for it. So I want you to learn the music that black folks really like within the call letters or coverage area of this station. He said, and I want you to, in the back, we have Associated Press, and United Press International. He said, I want you to go and pull news from those two outlets, but pull news only that you know relates to what you're hearing black people talk about. And then I want you to get the two black newspapers, Negro newspapers, the Southern Mediator Journal and the State Press, which was owned by Daisy and Elsie Bates, who handled the school integration crisis here in Little Rock with the Little Rock Nine 60 years ago this September 25th. He said, I want you to pull the news from those two newspapers that you hear people talking about or what they might want to hear, and pull it together, and then that five-minute newscast. He said, do you know why I'm telling you this, Al? I said, no, sir. He said, well, I want you to play black music that black folks like, because, Al, white people like the same music that black people like. So, when you play that, you're going to have the black audience and you're going to have the white audience. He said, and the reason I want you to do the news like that is because white people want to know what black people are talking about. he said, so when you do the kind of newscast I'm telling you about, the first thing, you're going to have the authorities listening. You're going to have the police, the sheriff, and everybody listening to see what you're saying. And all the white people will be listening. And you'll be giving the news to the black people that they need to hear. And I got to tell you, from that day until this day, I have lived that. And what that man told me then was so accurate, and it caused me to understand a lot about our music, our people, and about America, period. And realized...
What was the name of this radio station, Al?
K-O-K-Y.
And that was from what city?
Little Rock, Arkansas.
Little Rock,
yeah.
Yeah, it was part of...
And how long did you work for them?
I worked for them from the latter part of 1957 throughout 1958 and parts of 59.
Uh-huh. Okay, so now what are you doing in 59? What happens in 1959?
In 1959, I was in college and working on the station, but my English literature teacher, Mrs. V.R. Robinson, was listening to me constantly on the radio. I know she respected me as a student, and she would call me and tell me she wanted me to come by and talk to me because she wanted me to go and join up with the Reverend Martin Luther King. And I said, I don't know, who is Reverend Martin Luther King? So she told me some things about him. I said, but Mrs. Robinson, I said, you know, I'm in school and I'm working here at the station and I'm, you know, enjoying what I'm doing. She said, but I want you to meet Reverend Martin Luther King and join up with him. And that lady would not leave home until she asked me to come by her house one day, and she got Dr. King on the phone. And we talked. I mean, I don't remember the conversation, but whatever it was, you know, it impressed me enough because it did strike the core of me. Remember, in 57, we had that school integration crisis here, fighting for equal rights in Little Rock. So what Dr. King was talking about was already in me. And she said, well, I want you to go with him and get involved. And he invited me to come and get involved at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference workshops. And it taught leadership in Midway, Georgia. So I got to tell you, I left Little Rock, Arkansas, and I went to Midway, Georgia. Left college and radio, went to Midway, Georgia, and joined up with Dr. King and studied in those SCLC workshops until I left on one occasion and ended up coming back to Little Rock and getting back in school and getting back on radio, not in Little Rock, but after that in Memphis, Tennessee.
So you're in Tennessee now?
Yes, in Tennessee. I was at... a radio station, WLOK, in Memphis, Tennessee. Enjoyed it. That's where, while in Memphis in radio, still doing morning drive and afternoon drive. And by the way, I was number one in Little Rock and number one morning and afternoon drive in Memphis, Tennessee. And it was because of what Ed Phelan taught me. Mm-hmm. When I went to Memphis, Tennessee, I went around to all of the clubs and every place else under the sun to see what music black people were listening to and enjoying, and that's the music I played.
And were you playing, was your programs R&B programs, or were they gospel programs, or were they a mixture of both?
Well, in Little Rock, it was gospel on Sunday and jazz on Sunday afternoon. But after that, it was a mixture of both. When I did morning and afternoon drive, there were certain Oh Happy Day and songs like that, certain songs like that that I would integrate in because I knew the people wanted to hear them. And I'd play B.B. King and come out of that into a gospel song. Or a quartet, or what it was, quartets then, quartet songs, not necessarily a gospel song, but a quartet song, because I mean, we had some phenomenal quartets out here, you know, the Dixie Hummingbirds, the Sensational Nightingales, and those brothers, they were getting down.
I used to go see those Dixie Hummingbirds, the Swanee Quintet, Swan Silvertone, Stone Stars, Pilgrim Travelers. I used to go see them when I was like 13, 14 years old, when they used to come to Atlanta, Georgia. They used to play the City Auditorium.
Well, it's Pilgrim Travelers, that's where I met Lou Rawls. I met Sam with the Soul Stirrers. And Johnny Taylor when he was still with the Highway QCs.
Before he took Sam's place.
Yes, that's right. With the Soul Stirrers, right. And then when Sam went to Los Angeles and started Sar Records, he brought Johnny out with him.
Right.
That was a great
experience. So out of that that experience with the white guy in Little Rock, he gave you a foundation for what, you know, became popular for a minister today called Purpose Driven Life. He gave you something that allowed you to lock in the radio or that kind of business with a purpose, didn't
he? A purpose, and as a result of it, an understanding of people. I consider myself a social science marketer because I really study and understand and relate to people, just people. I'm a people person. And he gave me what I needed to really interact and just, I mean, through music, when you talk to people about music and they really talk to you, I mean, you really get to hearing a lot. You're talking about getting an education. You know, Dr. Daly, you're a musicologist. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so it did. It gave me what I needed.
Okay. Well, because at the end of the day, you know, if you're a marketeer, people are pretty important in your process.
So
you need to know them for persuasive purposes, but also your foundation, your spiritual foundation, wouldn't allow you to have handled it any other way, because you're, heart-wise, you're always looking for the good, right?
Yes. Yes, I understood that he was omnipresent, everywhere present and everything at the same time. So I just looked for the creator of the universe and everything at all times.
And so at this stage, had you now gotten the radio bug in such a way that you're now focused on it? I mean, you go back and forth to school, but you are locked in to developing your life around that part of life. Am I right about that? Had you gotten to that place?
Yeah, I'd gotten to that place. I was a pre-med major.
Okay.
I'm sorry. And I was a pre-med major, and I changed my major to political science, which on an undergrad level was pre-law. Because I figured, if I do anything other than get involved in the Senate, that I might be an attorney. But I realized later on I didn't want to do that. But I also, back then, which is really important that it taught, gentleman in this town in Little Rock, while I was here, he started me promoting concerts because he would provide the for me to book with him Jackie Wilson, Sam Cooke, you name it, the Fantabulous Rock and Roll Show, all of it. So I learned concert promoting back during that period of time also. So by the time I left Little Rock, I was a quasi-veteran in promoting concerts as events, because that was his attitude, not just the artist, make it an event and then bring in the artist, which was the philosophy I used behind putting together Wattstats, turning it into an event.
And that was quite a contribution you made doing Wattstats. And based on you introducing Wattstats, that means that we're going to be bouncing around. We usually try to be linear in our discussions, but this is one. No. This is one that's outside of the boundaries, and so we can't be locked into a straight line. Speaking of Wattstats, you had an opportunity to utilize the passions associated with social interaction and still make use of the media lessons that you learned, right?
Yes. It was the social interactions that allowed us to, one, format the show in the manner that we did, and we tried to cover and did, in fact, cover at that time every aspect socially and musically of our culture and put it on that stage there. And then we came back and did, if you've seen it, we came back and did photo shoots that were candid. People didn't know we were shooting them. And then one scripted scene in there, but it was designed to show, I had on my mind, amongst other things, knowing at that time how whites and the authorities were concerned about when any time two or more of us got together, I wanted to be able to demonstrate that, you know, two or more of us can come together and you don't have to be concerned about a problem.
Right.
I was thankful that God allowed us to pull together 112,000 of us, but it was every segment of our community there. We had the Crips, the Bloods, Ruby Dee, Ozzy Davis, you name it. Every segment of our community there, but I wanted to show that so people could see that, and then let us see us together and see and hear every aspect of our music. You heard all of it there, the jazz, the blues, the gospel, you name it. And in the scenes, you get to see us in life. As a matter of fact, I was so thankful that we had captured what we captured when we ended up with our documentary titling it Wattstats, which is what it was. I had to put a subtitle on it called Living Word. And they all were saying, yeah, they said, well, no, you shouldn't do that. That's being sacrilegious. I said, no. I'm not being sacrilegious. Call this the Living Word. I said, they call the Bible the Living Word, but when you read the Bible, what you see now is the history of the children of Israel, the Israelites. I said, and in there, the good and the ugly is there. And good, but it's all in the Living Word. And this Wattstats is a reflection of the Living Word as it relates to our culture and us at this time in life. And that's why that.
Great.
Since I was fat, they couldn't say no.
Yeah.
Hey, Al, I wanted to ask you one thing. I don't want to go back too far, but you said when you first started, you were playing jazz. Now, how did you get into jazz? Because that was a surprise.
I started playing gospel, and that was Sunday morning, and then that Sunday afternoon was jazz.
Yeah.
Well, Ed Phelan, that station manager, wanted jazz, and I knew a little bit about jazz. And what I started doing then was going to the college campus there, Philander Smith College, and hanging around the fraternities, because the guys in the fraternities played a lot of jazz and blues when they had their events. So I'd hang around them. They would allow me to do it. You know?
Was that back in the days of Dave Brubeck? Or was that before Dave Brubeck?
Yeah, no, that Dave Brubeck. That was Dave Brubeck. Brubeck and all of that. Brubeck. what's his name that played? I signed him at Stax, the trumpet player. But
oh,
anyway,
Miles, Miles Davis?
Not that Miles. Not Miles. It was the white guy.
Oh, Chet Baker.
No. Doggone it. I can't think of his name right now. But
Mangione?
No.
Okay, well that's fine. Go
right
ahead.
But it was during the days of we had two great organ players, Jimmy Smith,
yes.
and that was back during the Jimmy Smith days.
Earl Groove Holmes.
Yes, sir. All of those. I didn't get a chance to get as deep into jazz in terms of my understanding and appreciation for the diversity and uniqueness of it as I did in the other music, but I grew to appreciate it and understand it.
Yes, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, now Al, let me ask you this: you started in radio, and you started promoting concerts as well. And I imagine this is in the 60s, right?
Say again.
Yes. You're doing radio and you're also promoting concerts.
Yes.
Okay. Now this is happening in the 60s, right?
Well, it's happening in the 50s. It's happening in 57, 58, 59, and then I kept on after that.
Okay.
Oh, yeah,
what I'm trying to get to is what were you doing before you went to Stax? What year did you go to Stax?
I went to Stax in 1965.
65. Okay, so what were you doing before 1965, in the 60s?
I was working at WUST Radio in Washington, D.C., and booking concerts in the Howard Theater and at Wilmer's Park in Brandywine, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing morning and afternoon drives and radio and booking concerts still in Washington, D.C.
Right. So you began to get a name in the business. People are beginning to know you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, he was Al Bell.
Yo.
How did your relationship with Jim Stewart begin?
Well, when I left, I was in Memphis. I met Jim briefly in Memphis, and I had a great appreciation for the Stax music. Went by the studio, David Porter, who wrote with Isaac Hayes, would visit me at the radio station there in Memphis all of the time, and really promoting their music. And one day I asked him to take me by Stax, and he took me by. And when I walked in and looked in Studio A, and I saw these two white guys and these two black guys playing this funky soul music, I was in awe. It blew my mind. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I was Booker T in there.
Yeah.
I said, what? Now, this is we're in the belly of racism, man, Memphis, Tennessee, and segregation. Please. Inside that building and that kind of music. Well, David wanted me, when I got the offer to come to Washington, D.C., David Porter said, man, you should take that job. I said, well, I don't know whether I want to go to Washington, D.C. He said, well, no, you should take that job, man, and go to Washington, D.C. That's a big city and a big area, and you can play our music there and help us, you know, build what we're trying to do at Stax and make some money. And we can sell our records and get our writers' royalties and all that. And I thought about it for a while, and I got to thinking about Washington and the city itself at that time, and decided to take the job. So I took the job and went there and started playing Stax music and the R&B music of that period, you know, Joe Tex and Joe Simon and all of those guys there in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Dina, who owned the station, hired me. I mean, paid me good money. He was very impressed with what I was doing. I was getting five figures back then. And combined with the concerts, I was, you know, high five figures, doing all right. and playing that soul music, if you will. And one day Dan Dina came to me and said, you know, Al, we have a different breed of black people in Washington, D.C. They're more sophisticated. And, you know, this music that you're playing, your Otis Redding and Sam and Dave and all that stuff, not Sam and Dave at that time, but Otis Redding, Rufus Thomas, Carla Thomas, Joe Tex and all of that. So that's not sophisticated. You need to be playing more of the Motown music and the kind of music that they appreciate in this end of the country, because black people are more sophisticated here. So I went on the air the next morning at 6 o'clock and started playing all of that soul and R&B music and gave those people his home phone number and said, call him. Because I'd already done what Ed Phelan told me to do. I already checked out the markets. I knew what the people wanted to hear, so I wasn't taking a risk. But I had them call his house and tell. I said, call him and tell him if you like this music or not. And I did the morning show in Bethesda, Maryland, on a golf course. I think it may have been the 8th tee where the transmitter was set up. So I broadcast in the morning from the transmitter. And the lines from down radio station out to the transmitter, I took the phones off the hook so he couldn't get me. And by the time I finished my show, the engineer was knocking on the door, which I had locked, and put the phone back on the hook. And they said, Mr. Dean, I want you to come downtown immediately. Well, I left. I said, okay, well, yes. I left Bethesda, drove to 815, I believe it was, V Street, Northwest in Washington, D.C., and tried to get to the station, but I couldn't because there were too many cars. I couldn't find a parking place. I couldn't get through. So I parked, got out, and walked to the station. The streets were filled with people. Dan Dina, the owner of the station, who was about 5'1 or 5'2, had one of these long Cuban cigars in his mouth, and when I stepped around the corner, he said, there he is, ladies and gentlemen. This is Al Dale, come on, sign that autograph. And he just walked me through all of the people. And after it was over, he gave me $100 a week raise, put my picture on all the buses, and made me assistant station manager.
Al, yes. I'm trying to follow it chronologically. Yeah. Now, okay. This is before you went to work for Stax.
That's before I went to Stax.
Okay. Now let's get you at Stax now. And how do you get the job at Stax? How does Jim Steele get you?
Well, what happened when I went to Washington and started playing that Stax music and started selling in that area? And they couldn't get the product sold except in small markets and sold limited quantities at that time. I started playing there in Washington, increased the sales. As a matter of fact, really broke these arms of mine on Otis Redding. And it was impressing Jim, and Jim was impressed with me because I had my own label at that time, Suffice Records, distributed through Atlantic, just like Stax. And I went there on one occasion from Washington to Memphis to record some product on Eddie Floyd, who was an artist signed with me there in Washington, D.C. Jim was appreciating and respecting what I was doing with the music there and the success. And he said, he called me one day, and as a matter of time, they would record music, send me dubs, ask me to listen to it and give them my opinion on it, and not give them my opinion. It influenced what they would do mix-wise and otherwise on the music. And on one occasion, he called me and said, Al, listen. He said, you are a respected jock. All these jocks know you in this country. He said, and we have a problem here at Stax. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, we are 90,000 in the hole and about to go out of business. Atlantic isn't promoting our product. He said, and you know our product. And Estelle Axton, that's his sister, the AX and Stack, said, if we could get you to come here and take over and handle radio promotions that these disc jockeys would respect your ear and play the music, and you could help turn this company around. And if you would take that job and come here and do so, then we agreed to give you an equity interest in the company.
What was your official title when you went to SAC? What was your official title, Al?
I was a national director of radio promotion.
Okay.
Right.
But I was doing some of everything.
Yeah.
You know how that is.
Did SAC have a head of A&R?
Yes, a quasi-head of A&R, which was a guy by the name of Steve Cropper, who was the
Steve
guitar Cropper player.
Steve Cropper was head of A&R.
Yeah, he was the guitar player with Booker T.
I know he is. Yeah,
okay.
I know he is. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so now you're kind of in charge of promoting the Stax record, getting them airplay on radio stations in all the different territories.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Now let me ask you this: you have an involvement with the Staples Singers. How did that come about?
I have a what with the Staples Singers? I didn't hear.
Didn't you have a relationship with the Staples Singers?
Yes.
Did you produce them?
Yeah. Well, I met the Staples Singers when I was on radio at KOKY in Little Rock, Arkansas. I booked a concert in here. I was booking gospel concerts as well as the, quote, R&B concerts. The last one I did was Reverend C.L. Franklin, the Staples Singers, Aretha Franklin, who only had one record out at that time on Chess Records, Little Sammy Bryant, and the Swanee Quintet. I got a new walk there, just released that record at that time. But anyway, that's when I met the Staples. I did 5 dates on them, and I kept a relationship with them, and we became like family. And once I got to Stax, the one act I wanted to get was the Staples Singers because I respected their uniqueness and
right,
them.
Right.
I mean, they were just, I mean, they're still incredible. I got a chance to sign them. I negotiated, got an agreement, signed them, brought them to Stax, and let Steve Cropper produce them. And Steve Cropper produced an excellent album on them. But ultimately, to make a long story short, I ended up producing them and writing that one big hit for them. It was written through me, but I'll Take You There.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great song.
Yeah, that was a great song. It still stirs the soul even today, Al. That was a great song. Now, I understand that particular piece that you wrote has a deeper connection to life experiences for you. Is that right?
That's correct. I did not write it, and I let people know that it was written through me. Prior to that, I had my 2 baby brothers in a row murdered, and I had set a session up to go into Muscle Shoals to record the Staples Singers, and he was murdered, and I stopped everything and came to Little Rock busy looking for who had murdered my brother. At that time in my life, I hadn't reconciled death, and it was really bothering me. And got busy looking, thought I had found the person. When I got to the person, that person wasn't the person that had done it. And one of the fellows that came with me said, "Hey, man, you know, they're going to bury your brother tomorrow. The funeral is tomorrow. You've been busy out here doing what you've been doing. You got to go back and get with the family." So I went back, went to the funeral the next day. And after the funeral, we came back to my father's house, you know, where they have the repast where people get together and interact and et cetera. But I couldn't feel that. I couldn't do it. I went out into his backyard, and in his backyard on an oak tree, he had an old school bus, a yellow school bus that he used to use to haul cotton choppers and cotton pickers to the cotton fields. And it was there to remind him of where he had come from. But I sat on the head of that bus dealing with my brother's death. And as I sat there, just out of my mouth came dum, 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 dum. I don't know where or how that came. And I started singing. I know a place, ain't nobody crying, ain't nobody worried, ain't no smiling faces lying to the races. I'll take you there. And from that point on, I just emoted. and I let it all go. Something happened to me. Something happened to me. And there's only one verse in that song. That one verse in that song. But I went back and tried to write others, but I couldn't write anymore. Nothing else worked. It was just that one verse. And that started me into, took me, rather, into the I don't know how to really express this, but into the spiritual place that I needed to be to reconcile and understand death and really understand who, what I really was and am. That song gave us.
Yeah. I knew it was a special piece for you. And have you been able to sustain relationships with the artists that you've worked with over the years? I mean, because I know you were a number of them. You were more than just their boss. You really were friends with them.
Yeah, I was friends with them, and they became like family members. I had, well, like all families, you have some problems. And I had some disagreements with a couple of them. But really, I maintained a relationship just because of their lack of understanding on certain things. But I maintained a personal relationship with all of them and felt differently about all. They all were the same to me. People ask me, well, who was your favorite artist? There's no favorite artist. They were all my favorite artists because they all you know what I mean? Come on.
Right.
You couldn't put them in a box. You had to put each one of them in its own category. I mean, they were authentic and unique and different from the creator.
Now, you had a sort of the I won't call it special, but a unique relationship with Otis Redding, though, didn't you?
Oh, my God. Yes. Otis was as close to, or maybe closer to me, than a brother. And, and a dear friend. We lived and interacted that way. I mean, I knew more about him probably than his family because he would talk to me about all of the things that he was encountering. And, I mean, I can't explain that. When his plane crashed and he was killed, it almost took me out of here. And it took me somewhere between 10 to 15 years before I could even listen to an Otis Redding record or hear him sing again after that. That almost took me out of here.
The only thing I can say about Otis Redding is he's the only artist I think that I have read about that nobody has a bad word to say about
him. Yep. No, sir.
Yeah.
And there are several people that have wanted to do motion pictures around his life. And they get to a certain point, and I've talked to them, and they stop and said, well, we can't do it. I said, well, why? Why? This is a great man. Yeah, Al, but, you know, you got to have drugs, and you got to have the woman problems, and you got to have, and we can't find any. We can't find any of that, so there's nothing to tell. What do you mean there's nothing to tell?
They want dirt. They want dirt.
They want dirt.
Yeah, they want dirt, yeah.
He was a solid citizen. That's for sure, and a really dedicated family man too.
Yes. Oh man.
Now, as we come close to, I mean, this hour has gone by like that.
It's crazy, unbelievable.
Let's talk about what you're doing now and where your vision. What your vision is going forward, Al?
Well, I am working on many things, but at the center of all of those things, I'm working on putting together a new infrastructure for entrepreneurs in the recorded music, performing, concert performing in the of the business because it's all been destroyed. And yes, and I put together a new paradigm for recording artists who are really performing artists, but a new paradigm where they can come in and it's a business relationship, but they're not signed to a record company to work with them to put them in business and use the recorded music only as a marketing and advertising component to increase or create asset value and name recognition and create a demand for their concert performances so that they can go out and perform like they should. And I'm only going to deal with unique singers and rare performing artists, but the critical part of it is, most important part, is that they will have an equity ownership in all of the assets that are created as a result of their talent and not be treated like they've been treated in the past.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, you turn the industry upside down.
Well,
that's a wonderful dream.
I've been dealing with it for quite some time, but the time is now. What does Solomon say? There's a time and a season for all things. The time is now, and I want to.
How's the industry responding, Al, to your ideas?
Well, I haven't talked to because it's a waste of time. I don't mean this negative. I mean it objectively. To talk to the three major companies, because I mean, you know, they have their models, and it's about not about the art and artistry and the artist, it's about bottom line. And now they're into mass merchandising, which is another one like the other one, like McDonald's or Burger King, and not unique artists. So it's no need of me talking to them about it. That's why I have to put in an infrastructure myself that allows us to be able to effectively market and distribute the artist in the marketplace. And that has to be built, and I'm working on building it. And I've got to tell you, the positive side is once the majors see it developing, they'll want to do business because they need something to save them now.
They sure do. Sure do.
Yeah, they bought up everything, you know, and killed off all that they couldn't buy up.
Yeah.
Just like the automotive industry did. We got the big three now. When we had 30 or 40, now we have the big three.
Yep. But, you know, the industry, it seems to me, has positioned itself where it'll never be able to put a stranglehold on the industry as it was before because of technology and the savviness on the part of the artists.
Yes.
I mean, they're no longer joyful about performing for a new car, you know.
Yes.
Some of them, there are some that are like that still, but by and large, these kids are coming out smart, man.
Well, they are, and some of them are still using the smartness to try to get themselves in a position to attract, quote, the new car, if you will. But they're talking about millions of dollars. They're talking about millions of dollars now. They're thinking differently.
So now they attract
the new car would attract millions of dollars. With their technology, they've only been able, with the exception of one in particular, Chance the Rapper. Are you familiar with him?
I am.
Yeah, I know. He's big. He's big at the moment, yeah.
Oh, he's huge, man. He's huge. And independent and using all of that new technology out here, not associated with any of these companies. And for him to go and win. Yeah, from Chicago, yes. I mean, he's proven that it can be done and has figured out a way to do it. The others, they're doing what they're doing and creating a demand for performances, but they're still based on their knowledge of how to cause things to happen to create that kind of demand. They haven't figured out how to do that just yet, but they are working and making a living using the new technology and expressing their talent, and I'm thankful for that.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. Well, that's great. Now, just one last piece that I am curious about, and we can begin to wind it down, is your journey at the head of Motown.
Right.
Quickly expressed what that unwinding was. What was that like? I mean, you were there to see the twilight of a giant.
Yeah, well, I was brought in to cut to the chase. I was brought in by Berry Gordy, my dear friend, to work with him based on my experiences and what I had experienced, what I had learned, and his experiences and what he was going through, to aid him in figuring out if he could save it based on what the majors were doing to him, and turn it around, or if he would have to sell it, which he didn't want to do. But we ended up agreeing that it was in his best interest to sell it and save himself, if you will, and make some money for himself before they killed it and killed him.
Yeah.
I mean, I just cut cut to the chase on it.
Mm. Yes, you did. Put it out there bluntly. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it's the truth. And it's a fact. It's the truth.
Yeah, I hear you. The truth hurts.
And you, but you know what? I was so proud. Let me tell you what I was so proud of, though. See, Barry had been placed in the position of being number one in terms of black-owned businesses, and I was number two as it relates to black-owned businesses. And what was so beautiful about that was that here were two. You know, back then they say we couldn't work together and get anything done. Well, here Barry and I were able to come together as two black men and work together to realize a goal and objective that was beneficial to both of us. Mm-hmm. Beneficial for me because it mainstreamed me after having fought all I fought, and beneficial to Barry because it helped him save his company or the assets of his company and the revenue from those assets. So it both was beneficial, and we both knew that going in. We had a mutual understanding. It wasn't a normal kind of relationship, if you know what I'm saying.
I do.
That was historical, and I'm thankful for that, and hope that a lot of our young people will see that we don't have to compete with each other, because Barry and I didn't compete with each other. We can work together for the benefit of both.
Yes.
Yeah. That's great. And I, selfishly speaking, I would love an opportunity to have this same kind of conversation with him at some point. So if you happen to see an opportunity for me to engage, I'd really be interested in it. Well, I tell you,
I'll try to do that.
Okay. All right.
It won't be easy because, you know, Barry doesn't talk that much.
Yeah. That's all right. We got some skills to draw it out. So
we draw it out.
we
get that.
We so much appreciate you taking the time to spend with us, and I just can't tell you how much I have admired you over the years, and I shared with the fellows from our last conversation, it was as if I was channeling Effie Smith, because I felt like, you know, I had the same kind of relationship with you as she did, and I've never really sat down long enough with you for you to even remember me. But it just felt like that, you know. You electric coming through the phone, honest, straightforward. Don't ask me a question if you don't want the straight answer. You know, that kind of person.
Yes.
Yeah. And so we're just very thankful. And John, you want to say your to-dos?
Yeah. Al, listen. Thank you. You were working around the Howard in around 1957, 58.
What, in Washington? No, not 1957. I was in Little Rock.
Okay, Little Rock. Okay.
No, because I used to be in a group called the Velours, and we used to work at Howard a lot. Mm.
Yeah, I didn't work at Howard until 1964, 63 and 64.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, we were gone by then. Yeah. Yeah. But listen, thank you very much, because, I mean, you know, it's very rarely that you get a chance to speak to somebody who's really had a career like that, you know, especially when you've been doing so many great things.
Thank you.
That's great. George?
Yes. Al, it's been a pleasure talking to you and finding out the story of your life. And thank you for all of your contributions to the music business, especially
Black
music business. Really appreciate it.
Well, yeah. I thank you all. You know, there's a lot that can be done going forward. I'd like for us to do this again so we can really get out here and share this information with people, because you can't get it at Howard or Harvard. I'd like to share more. I don't want to go into my grave with me.
Yeah.
Well, consider it done.
Anytime you need us.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I would love to do a focus totally on Stax and the work you did there with the people who may still be around. That would be a project I'd be very interested in, Al.
Well, let's get it done.
Okay, very good. Any parting comments for those?
For
those young folks that hopefully were inspired by realizing where you came from, the kind of commitments that you not only made to yourself and the work area that you focused on, but how important the outcome has been for you. Just like your relationship with Barry Gordy, it wasn't me, it was us. And
yes.
So would you say something to the youngsters so they'll know?
Well, you know, it's as I look at it today, most important thing is coming together and working together to help each other. But on a personal level, to each one individually, don't accept that it can't be done. If you believe that you can do it, make up your mind to do it, and don't let anything stop you, regardless of what it is that you're doing in life. Be persistent, persist, believe in it can be done. Make up your mind and do it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's the
Exactly.
All right. Tied up enough of your time, so thank you so much for being with us. And
yes, thank you very much.
Take this with you, and I really mean it, and I think the other fellows do too. We love you, man.
Yeah.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank God. I love you, brother.
Right.
Thank you very much. All right.
Guys. What do you think?
Well, I guess nothing else to say, but.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yes, sir. You too. Okay, guys, what do you think? I mean, couldn't take it any further, could we?
No.
That was very enjoyable. Very enjoyable.
See, I told you. Yeah. I told you, Lou, once we got started, you weren't going to have time to go to the railway. You had to put that in later.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Underground Railroad information is important, but it wasn't important enough to break up this conversation, I tell you.
No. No way.
It's really wonderful. I was looking forward to it, and I knew it would be this way based on the energy I felt in our last conversation.
Mm.
And I tell you, man, we've come to a place now where there's really not anything else that we need to talk about in regards to this, other than figuring out a schedule where we can bring him back again. Don't you think so?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right. Exactly.
So So in that case, there's only one thing left for us to do.
Bye.
Okay, the conductor is telling us it's time to move on. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Let us know by sending an email to info@clioexchange-express.com. That's info@clioexchange-express.com. Until next time, we wish you peace of mind, love from the heart, and happiness you cannot explain.